Hello, Beth.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. Where are you?
I'm actually in my bedroom, which for our listeners' sake is a unfinished basement with concrete floor and walls, but we make it cozy. Lots of soft surfaces.
I'm in a bedroom right now as well. I'm in a bedroom in a basement in Boise, Idaho. It's my brother's house. And if you hear just the ever so subtle fluttering of a fan, it's because there's a radon pump down here. Because it turns out, I guess, Boise has a radon problem. So it's to keep me from breathing too much radioactive gas, you know? We never do this, Beth. We never do the like two-way host lead, you know, where we pretend we're in the same room and talk to each other like chatty people, you know? I kind of wonder sometimes if listeners know that we know each other.
Right.
What I was really excited to do in this, and I'm upset that I can't, Beth, is I was going to show you how I can make a really cool audio feedback through the baby monitor that my family has. And I think I'm going to do the show's header that we do. I was thinking about doing that through the baby monitor and then like running some like really terrible feedback by putting the monitor really close to the camera. So that it just turns into this echoing mess. So I think I'll probably cut that in as soon as I can find the other piece of the baby monitor. From KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters. Okay, so Beth, last week in our meeting, you had come to me and asked me if I remembered some things from the 90s. And I remember a lot of things from the 90s, but you had mentioned this movie about like someone who gets stuck in time. And there was this book about like this evil stepdad who gets shot into space. And yeah, that didn't really ring any bells to me. But I was wondering if maybe there's some listeners who also grew up in the 90s who might have consumed some of this media as children. And so I was hoping you could just like describe these two different things to people. And then we'll get into the episode, you know, the whole episode. But just really quick, like, what are the plots of these two pieces of media you consumed?
Yeah. So I'll start with the movie. There's an older man who builds a time machine, and the time machine is pretty, it looks very like steampunk. That's because the man is from the past and he travels to the future, you know, 1995 or whatever. So the man gets to the future and his time machine is broken and he needs help fixing it. And luckily he makes friends with some local kids who help him find the parts that he needs to fix his time machine. But before he is able to fix it all the way, the kid's parents find out that they've been hanging out and spending time with this man. So they end up calling the authorities and the cops come and confiscate his unfinished time machine and take him into custody. And what really stuck with me is this image of this man who the whole first part of the movie is just fun and jovial and friendly. He is crying. He just his face is totally covered in tears and he's just crying and calling out saying, "I just want to go home. I just want to go home." I don't remember how the movie ends, but that scene in particular really has stuck with me all these 20 something years later.
Yeah.
And then, so the book that I remember, there's a family. I believe there are three kids and a mom and a stepdad. And the stepdad is kind of mean. And the mom ends up dying. And then afterwards, there's an alien that gets into their house. Like, I think it gets down their chimney somehow. And it posts up in one of the closets in the house. And throughout the course of the book, this alien changes the house into a spaceship. It's building a spaceship in the house. And meanwhile, the mean stepdad thinks that the kids are changing the house and he gets mad at them. And the climax of the book is the kids realize that the alien is turning the house into a spaceship and is about to take off. And they decide to lock their mean stepdad in the closet so that he will be shot out into space. And they manage to do that, and they all get out of the house right as the spaceship that is their house is taking off with their mean stepdad locked inside. And that also has stuck with me for decades now. The thought of being trapped in a spaceship that you didn't know was a spaceship and then being shot off I always thought it was really, really frightening. And it's stuck with me all these years.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, like both of those stories that your mind is stuck on are about being trapped away from your true home, you know. Mm-hmm. But you said that, like, through all your research and from asking your friends and, like, online, you can't figure out what these stories are.
Yeah, I have not had any success tracking down this book or this movie. I've checked some message boards. I've posted on message boards. I've asked a bunch of my friends. And so far, have never talked to anyone else who has heard of or seen or read either of these. So yeah, so I put the question to you, dear listener, if you know what I'm talking about, if you have seen this movie or read this book and can share the titles with me, please do. We do have a phone line. The phone number is 765-374-5263. I would be really grateful if anyone out there can point me in the direction of either this movie or this book.
Yeah, I think it'd be great if we could find the names of these stories, Beth. I mean, these kind of ideals of familial terror fit pretty deeply with the kind of mission statement of the show, or what we sometimes call, you know, our invisible mission statement, the stuff that we've never written down, but we talk about in pretty much every meeting, like fear and terror and disgust to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. Okay, after the break, we're going to change gears here into a interview, which from a pure like topic level has very little to do with, you know, aliens and time travel, but actually has kind of a strange similarity in that it's something that's really stuck with me. About 3 years ago, I was listening to another great podcast called Rationally Speaking. It's a podcast hosted by Julia Galef. And she was interviewing this guy named Dylan Matthews, who's a senior writer over at Vox. And it struck me, I guess, because in that interview, he talked about this idea of a quality-adjusted life year, what's called a quali, or at least that's the pronunciation that I've chosen to give it. It's kind of this idea that there are different kinds of things that can improve other people's lives. You know, you can spend ridiculous amount of resources and money to put someone on life support and get an extra, you know, year out of their life where they, you know, lay on a hospital bed and very well might be miserable. Or you can do these other things that take less effort and can have massively good results for people. And Dylan's part of this movement called Effective Altruism that argues that we should be, you know, focusing our attention on actions that we can do that really extend the quality years of people's lives. And she was talking to him about something that I don't know. It was something that seemed kind of like disturbing and gross to me at first. She was talking to Dylan about his kidney donation. He was a voluntary kidney donor, what's called a non-directed donor, meaning he just gave it. He didn't ask for one in return for someone he knew with kidney disease. He just said, whoever needs his kidney can have this kidney. It's made me uncomfortable because he made some really compelling arguments for like why we should be considering giving away our extra organs. But there's a lot of skepticism of people who seem too saintly. I think those are Dylan's words. Like, what kind of special human are you that you're like willing to like give someone a part of your body? And Dylan's big cause is trying to break down this perception that those who give their organs voluntarily are somehow saintly. He says that it's like actually a pretty normal thing to do. I too kind of had this perception of, you know, organ donors as these like special type of person that, you know, vows to live in poverty and doesn't consume anything that's touched plastic in their lives. And it's like, no, he's like, this is something that normal people can do. So that's what the interview after the break is. Thanks, Beth, for indulging me in this kind of funny intro to the show. Maybe we should turn this podcast into a chat cast, don't you think? It's kind of fun to actually talk to you every now and then, you know?
Thanks, Jeff.
Let's hang up and let the show progress.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. Have a good rest of your evening.
Okay, you too.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
a weird way to spend a few weeks.
The podcast about
the unknown.
I was wondering if you could just, in simple terms, explain what the kidney is and why it's important.
Sure. So, and with the understanding that I'm not a nephrologist, the kidney is an organ that typically people have two of, and it is a kind of filtration system to try to filter out toxins and particularly sort of nitrogen out of the bloodstream. It's sort of the interface between your blood and your pee is one way to think about it.
Do you remember when you first found out how bad the need for kidneys was?
I think the first time I thought about it in any complexity was when Larissa McFarquhar, who's a reporter at The New Yorker, wrote a piece on people who give their kidneys to strangers. I'd heard sort of, I would give my kidney for that is kind of like a cliche saying for I would give a lot for that, that sort of giving your kidney has some kind of weird cultural resonance in a way that I think partially reflects how big the demand is. But it was really Larissa's piece walking through just how big the shortage is, how long the waiting list to get one is, and as a consequence of that, how much someone who has a kidney to give and is willing to give it can do. That was the first time I thought about this with any kind of depth. I read that piece in 2009, I think, and I donated in the summer of 2016, and I started the process about a year before that. And in between that time, I'd been sort of thinking about it ambiently. Like, I knew it was something people did. It was something that I wanted to do at some point in my life. It was really in 2015 where I buckled down and said, no, this is something I actually really want to do. How do I make this happen?
Do you have any idea each year in the U.S. how many people die waiting for kidneys?
About 40,000.
40,000.
So about 40,000 people die because they're on the kidney waiting list and couldn't get a kidney.
40,000 is a lot.
It is a lot of people. It's more than guns kill every year in the U.S. It's more than suicides. It's like quadruple the number of homicides in the U.S. per year. It's a lot. There are so many people who need kidneys that if you are like, if you don't care who gets your kidney like at all, there's someone who could use your kidney.
The things that we're afraid of, right, don't in my mind seem to follow any logical flow. Like, it's not a numbers thing. It's something else. I don't know a single person who's ever like come to me seeming stressed out about future kidney failure.
Right.
Or dying on a wait list for an organ. But you're saying that this is actually a bigger health problem than, what did you say, guns and suicide and homicide.
Homicide, which are all very related with each other, obviously. But yeah, no, I mean, and I don't say that to diminish those at all. Suicide's a huge public health problem. Homicide, especially in particular neighborhoods, is a really horrific public health problem. But I think those scare us because they're sudden. So I think that's part of it. I think people are just like are not good at conceptualizing risks that don't feel like they come out of nowhere. Like things that people feel like they have some kind of control over or that are distant don't hit people as much. And this is both distant and something that I think because of the correlates to health and exercise and what have you, people feel like they have more control over. They're like, oh, well, I eat salads. I go to CrossFit. This won't happen to me. I mean, no one is going to go around their lives having a totally evidence-based perception of the risks they face. I always get very nervous when I'm on top floors of skyscrapers, even though I know intellectually that no one falls out the windows that often. But part of my job as a journalist, I think, is to surface big problems like that that don't pop out to people on their own.
This article that I was pointed to by you, or I guess it's a forum post, right? It's called Kidney Donation is a Reasonable Choice for Effective Altruists and More Should Consider It, right?
A very flashy headline.
I know, right? I think you mentioned that that's actually pretty good among the kind of like philosophy crowd, right?
Relatively catchy.
Yeah, it's a coherent sentence. Kidney donation is a reasonable choice for effective altruists and more should consider it. And what is that message? What is the best argument to say that like you know, you average person with functioning kidneys, you should donate one of those to a stranger.
I think the basic argument is it's not that high risk for you and it does a lot for another person. And that sounds really glib, but it's true. So your risk of serious health complications from this is really, really low. Most people are out of the hospital in a couple of days. At the same time, our best understanding is that these kidneys last maybe 10 or 15 years for the people who get them on average. And not only is that good, it's better than all the things that you could think of as alternatives that might give you an out so that you don't have to do this. So people always ask me, why don't you just wait until you die and then your kidneys will go to someone?
Right.
And people should do that. People should have like an organ donor thing on their ID. But those last more like 5 or 6 years. Right. So it's a 2 or 3-fold increase in the lifespan of the organ if you give while you're alive.
When you say the lifespan of the organ, that also means the lifespan of the person, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So if when the organ fails, they need either another transplant or they go back on dialysis. And dialysis, you know, if you're on it for too long, you will pass away. So you're adding maybe 10, maybe 15 years to a person's lifespan. You're maybe adding some multiples of that if you're part of a chain which gets multiple people kidneys, which we can talk about a bit more.
Yeah. Can you actually explain that idea of a donation chain?
In a simple world, you could just give a kidney to another person and they would automatically receive it. In a world where people have different blood types and different sort of antigens that they've developed over the years as they've gotten various illnesses and encounter various objects that they have allergies or not to, people's immune systems just work in really different ways. And so the subset of the population that could get a kidney from you and their body wouldn't attack it like it's a foreign body is pretty small. And so this has been a big barrier when trying to do like familial donations. So then when your loved one is looking for a kidney, they're sort of out of luck. So this movement kind of came along led by this economist named Alvin Roth, who was interested in matching, where the idea was to match two separate families where one had a kidney that was compatible with the other person's and vice versa. So you just swap kidneys. Everyone gets what they want. And his big realization was that you can do those simple swaps between two sets of people who need kidneys and have a loved one willing to donate for them. But you can also do them as chains. If one person gives a kidney to someone who needs it and is compatible, and then their loved one is promised a kidney from some third family, and so on and so on and so on. So that works really well. The problem is that you need to end it somewhere. That the nice thing about a swap is everyone gets what they want and it's simple and clean and it's done. If you keep this chain going, there's always someone who's giving a kidney and not getting one back unless you like find a way to loop it around, which seems incredibly difficult. And so the purpose that people like me who can give a kidney and not need one back serve in this process is that we can get the whole thing going. So I give a kidney to someone, his family member donates a kidney to someone else who needs it, who donates a kidney to someone else who needs it. And so you can get that chain going. And because I don't need a kidney back at the end of it, it's a lot easier to make that chain longer.
I'm not sure if this is the way your brain works or not, Dylan, but like kind of in my head when I'm trying to decide something like this, which is like a very binary choice, right? Like you can't give half your kidney away. You either do it or you don't. How did you think about it?
It's funny. People always ask me this because it's a strange choice to make and people want to know where it came from. But it wasn't like a process of convincing myself this was a good thing to do. But it was a process of convincing myself that the obstacles to doing it were manageable. That like, yes, it's okay for me to take a few weeks off of work. I won't get fired if I do that. Yes, it's okay to take this risk and my folks will be okay with me doing it and they won't be too mad at me. Yes, my partner will be okay with it and will be supportive. The logic of you give up something relatively small to help another person a lot was never something I really struggled with. I kind of took that as a given. It was just, you know, it's one thing to say that, another thing to work out how exactly you would do that.
before it happened, before you went in for surgery, did you ever tell anyone that you were going to do this and then have a negative reaction from them?
Yeah, I don't talk about this a lot just because it's not her problem, but my previous partner was very adamantly against it, which I think was part of why I didn't do it for a few years, which I think is a good reason not to do it. Like, if you, it's a demanding thing, and you should consult the people close to you, and if they're not on board, you shouldn't do it. There's a lot that can go wrong, which I think is a fair and correct thing to observe. And I think it was also, you know, it just felt weird. I think, like, that's part of what repels people from it is the sort of, we're not people who do that. We play games with our friends and go to movies and visit beaches. And, like, it's a weird way to spend a few weeks. And it's just, like, a thing you have to explain to a lot of people. And then my parents were not against it, but were certainly concerned that I think for them, the most recent referent they had for someone being in a hospital was their parents. And so if your context for hospitals and hospital care is people at the end of their life really, really struggling, I think it makes a ton of sense to see your son wanting to go into one of those hospitals and be a little weirded out about it. But they were not, like, adamantly opposed to it. They understood why I was doing it, and once I made the decision to do it, they were incredibly supportive. My dad came down for the whole time and was sort of an essential part of my recovery. So I give them a ton of credit.
I was wondering if I could ask you a little bit about the surgery and what exactly happened to you in the hospital.
Sure. We got in around very early in the morning, like 4:30 a.m. They put me in a hospital gown and labeled the part of my body that they were going to do their incisions on. My doctor, like, signed part of it. Then I met with the anesthesiologist and started getting my general anesthetics. And then I woke up 3 or 4 hours later.
I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, I assume that you were in pain.
Yeah, I was in a great deal of pain. For laparoscopic surgery, which is what I had, where you're not, like, just fully opening up the abdomen, but you're making small incisions and then using a camera and some instruments that go through a small hole. So they can see better, they pump you full of carbon dioxide. And that sort of lifts up your, like, the skin of your torso and gives them a view of what they're doing. And then that carbon dioxide has to get reabsorbed into your body. And while it does that, like, the reabsorption itself is painful. But the other thing is that, like, it rises and it hits this nerve called the phrenic nerve that goes up to your neck. And so I was in, like, horrible neck pain for much of my time in the hospital, which is not something anyone told me. And so I try to tell people who donate to be prepared for that. But I found that the pain went away pretty rapidly, that, you know, you get up, you walk around, the gas gets reabsorbed, the cuts heal, and you stop feeling them as much. You stop needing to dial in as much painkiller as you had been your first day. And so I was out of the hospital by Thursday after surgery on Monday. So it's really, really rapid progress as soon as you get out of the operating room.
So who got your kidney?
It's a guy I respect for his privacy. I don't say his name or where he lives, but we email every year, usually around the anniversary. I can tell you he really likes motorcycles, likes riding Harleys. He recently got a Honda that he's really happy with. His daughter was his family member as part of the chain, and so she donated her kidney to another person the same day that I donated my kidney to her dad. He's a good guy. I was sort of two minds on wanting to meet my recipient, mostly because I didn't want him to feel like he owed me anything. Like, I didn't want him to feel any kind of social obligation to stay in touch with me or like be my buddy if he didn't want to do that. I'm not like buying a wing of a hospital so everyone tells me how nice I am. I wanted to give him a hand and not have him feel anything in return. But he wanted to know who the donor was, And so they put us in touch and gave us each other's email addresses. And I really appreciate it. And I think we're on a similar page where we live in different cities. We have our own lives, but we have this kind of nice connection with each other and are able to check in. And he's always very nice about it. He always tells me what our kidney is up to these days.
I mean, you said that he was on the wait list because he was waiting for a match. You matched with him. And therefore, because you matched with him, you didn't need a kidney back. His daughter was able to give to someone else and start one of these donation chains, right?
Yes, exactly.
So by the act of you giving up one kidney, how many kidneys were transplanted?
So we had a 4-kidney chain. So she donated a kidney, the person she donated to had someone who donated a kidney, and then the person they donated to had someone who donated a kidney. And then it ended with someone who had been on the waiting list without a family member. So they usually end with someone who is more socially isolated, which is something I appreciate. Like, they're in many ways some of the neediest folks, and I'm glad this process gives them a role. But yeah, so ours was 4. I think that's about average for chains like this. Some can get very, very, very long. There was a famous chain that got 30 kidneys to people. These are just sort of like logistical masterpieces. Janet Hiller, who is the social worker who worked on my chain, is just like a wizard. And I think people who go through the medical system sometimes are like, oh, my surgeon's a genius. And my surgeon was brilliant, and I appreciate everything he did for me. The person I came out admiring most is Janet Hiller, because she like just has a brain for making these connections and figuring out how the plane with the kidney will get to the place in time for the surgery. It's just mind-bendingly complicated work, and she's incredibly, incredibly good at it. And so I ended with really intense admiration for her and the other social workers and nurses who put all those together.
Are you at any increased risk of kidney problems later in your life because of this procedure?
I am. I think the best evidence I've seen on this suggests that my risk of kidney failure relative to an equivalently healthy person who didn't donate has increased about 3-fold. So someone about as healthy as a typical kidney donor has about 1/3% risk of kidney failure later in life. A kidney donor has about 1% risk. So it's about 3-fold increase. That being said, the general population is much less healthy than kidney donors in general. And so about 3% of the overall population has kidney failure later in life. An absolute risk of 1% is real, but not huge. I have like a 99% chance of being totally okay in that regard. And furthermore, the one benefit they do give you is that if I need a kidney, I get bumped to the top of the list. That they do give you a credit if you've donated and wind up needing a kidney back as part of the waitlist system.
Yeah, that's like one of those kidney donation perks, right?
Yeah, there aren't many, but there's, yeah.
Well, I mean, I want to ask you about that, like from a serious point. There's like these elements of social capital here that altruistic deeds carry, and I think a lot of the time that seems really unsavory to try to benefit from those sorts of things. You know, if you're walking around with a shirt that says "I gave $1 million to charity," people are going to look at you bad, right? Have you seen social capital that you've received for this act?
I think one thing I really try to do is make the point that this is not like a superhuman thing to do. That I'm not like a Medal of Honor winner. Like, I didn't do something uncommonly brave. The thing I don't want to do is, you know how like the sort of 30 Rock joke about people who went to Harvard saying like, oh, I went to college in Boston. Don't do that stuff. Like the more you act like it's a thing that people should like be deferential to you about, the more you seem like a jerk and they are deferential to you about. Like, the point I try to make is like, it's genuinely not a big deal. I had a surgery 3 years ago. I think it's a nice thing to do. I'm happy to talk to you about it if you want to do it. But I do think, and I think there's psychological research that backs this up by psychologists and neuroscientists who've studied kidney donors and people's attitudes toward them, that people get really suspicious about people who seem like too saintly. And so I think it's important to diminish our reputation as too saintly so that it feels more accessible to people. I don't know if that's exactly what you were asking, but.
No, I mean, it's a question that came to my mind when I was reading that article, the one which is titled Kidney Donation is a Reasonable Choice for Effective Altruists and More Should Do It. I think that's a point that the authors make in that post, which is saying like one of the reasons you should do it and talk about it is so that more people consider doing it, and that is a net good if we can make it seem more accessible, right? And one element of that I didn't feel like I came to any resolve about was this idea of if you donate a kidney and tell no one about it, then it kind of ends there, right? But if you donate a kidney and tell everyone about it in a way that makes it seem accessible, then you could potentially make a different kind of donor chain. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's entirely the reason why I wrote about it and why I did a podcast about it. I mean, I think it's different from some other kinds of doing good in that it's reasonably democratic. Like there are people who are in too poor health to donate, certainly. There's financial costs that come with donating. I don't mean to diminish those. But it's not like walking around with a shirt that said I gave $5 million to charity, because most people can never give $5 million to charity. Most people could at least look into giving their kidney. And so I think part of why it was important to me to talk about it and to be open about it is that there is that contagion effect. And it's not like I'm bragging about something that other people can't do. But I think part of what we find objectionable about bragging, not the only thing, but part of what's bad about it is that it places you above another person and in a way that is meant to stake a claim above them. And so part of what makes me okay talking about kidney stuff in as non-braggy a way as I can is that I try to be very clear that it doesn't place you above anyone, that this is a thing a lot of people can do. It is not some way in which people become superior to other people. But it's a reasonable, to use sort of the EA forum-like language, is a reasonable option that a lot of people can consider.
I wasn't actually 100% aware of this term effective altruists before I started listening to Rationally Speaking. And so this idea of effective altruism, like what is ineffective altruism? Just real quick.
So I think the classic example of ineffective altruism were these things called play pumps, which Jay-Z and the Clinton Foundation and a few other people funded, which were these merry-go-rounds that were supposed to function as water pumps in various African countries to get more clean drinking water. It turns out that merry-go-rounds are a really inefficient way to get water out of the ground. And so what happened was that you built these and children were forced to work like 18-hour days drudgerously turning the merry-go-round.
Oh my God.
It's like it would be hilarious if it weren't actively horrible.
Right.
But I think it was a part of a reaction to that and being like, look, there's all this stuff that seems cool and makes a good TED Talk and will get millions and millions of dollars of philanthropic interest because it seems good and makes a good TED Talk. But what if we like put our heads down and try to run the numbers more carefully? And so I think that's the initial impetus. But there's certainly an air of superiority to the name.
I mean, but at the same time, like I'm greatly appreciative of the fact that like the effective argument in that piece is saying, you know, it's like most people, you're looking at giving up maybe tops a month of your life to being in pain to alleviate, you know, 14 years of pain for someone else. That's a pretty compelling argument, right?
Yeah, I certainly found it compelling. And I think it's very much an argument in that tune of, you know, here's what it costs, here's what you get out of it. Let's compare that return on investment to some other things and see if it seems reasonable.
So for someone who listens to this and says, I want to know more, like I want to just take that first investigative step into setting this up for myself, like what do they do?
I generally point people to either Waitlist Zero or the National Kidney Registry. And I think an important thing to remember is that up until the moment that you're on a gurney and they're pulling you in, you have no obligation to donate. You can ask questions. You can see what the process entails. But I would say National Kidney Registry and Waitlist Zero were the two biggest resources for me. So I always point people there.
I really appreciate it, Dylan. And yeah, I'll send you a link when it comes out.
Perfect. Sounds good. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Dylan Matthews is a senior correspondent for Vox. His podcast is called Future Perfect, and it's about doing good. We have a link to Future Perfect up on our website, along with links to most of the things that Dylan mentioned on this episode. We're at hbmpodcast.com. A big thank you on this episode to Afim Shapiro for recording our interview with Dylan at Vox. My name is Jeff Entman. I produced this episode along with help from Bethany Denton. Remember that Beth is currently looking for some help finding some old media from the 90s. If you can help her out, please just leave us a voicemail at 765-374-5263. You can also send us an email via our website, which again is hbmpodcast.com. If you enjoy Here Be Monsters, please do us a big favor and rate and review the show wherever you listen. We're a small show. It's mostly just me and Beth, but we work really hard on it. And we're very proud to be a part of something bigger. That something bigger is KCRW, where our senior editor is Kristen Lepore. We get additional support for our freelance contributions from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Music on this episode by The Black Spot. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon.